He said, "I had a piece of film that I used to show myself all the time under the piano. It lasted 2 minutes, and you could see galloping horses' hooves, a mysterious stranger turning his head, a lady dressed in white lace holding a pair of opera glasses, and accompanied by a gentleman in a top hat. I saw this film hundreds of times, and it wasn't until almost 35 years later that I saw Renoir's Nana at the Cinematheque and suddenly shouted out, 'That's my piece!' So I would say I'm very much influenced by Renoir." Welcome once again to the Plastic Podcast. I'm Robert Davis. There's something unusual about today's episode, and we're not going to tell you what it is until we reach the midway point. That's about 28 minutes from now. We will reveal the unusual secrets. Those of you who've been following along may guess it. There are some clues, perhaps. We'll tell you what it is when we get there. The other unusual thing about this episode is that it's not about a particular film or filmmaker. It's not an interview. It's not a report from a film festival. It's just a casual, free-ranging conversation about an idea. We will be back next time to talk about a specific movie. We're watching Douglas Sirk's film Imitation of Life, which you have to see. You've got to put it on your list. And I hope you'll also join us when we talk about it and look at it fairly closely. That's next time. Here's J. Robert Parks.
Hi, Rob.
Hey, J. Robert.
I had an interesting experience a month or two ago. I went to see Mulholland Drive. Now, I hadn't seen this movie since it came out about 10, 11 years ago. And when it first came out, I really, really disliked it. I'm not much of a Lynch fan. I should probably say that up front. I like Blue Velvet a great deal. But a lot of other Lynch works sort of leave me either cold or baffled or irritated. And Mulholland Drive sort of was all of those things. And so, you know, I remember having arguments with friends, you know, when it came out and about what it meant. And I remember someone saying that they thought it was actually pretty easy to follow. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? I just found it completely mystifying. Because if you haven't seen the film, there's sort of a key switch that happens, you know, maybe about a halfway to two-thirds of the way through, where it suddenly seems to become almost at least a somewhat different movie. And it's not, at the beginning, you're not quite sure, is this the same character or is it the same actress playing two different characters anyway? So, and I'd kind of dismissed it, or at least dismissed it for myself. I mean, other people can like it. But it showed up on so many best of the decade lists. I mean, so many critics that I respect had this as their number one film of the decade or in their top 10. And I was thinking, wow, boy, I'm not usually that far out of sort of mainstream critical opinion. And so it happened to be showing at the Gene Siskel Film Center earlier last year, or, you know, towards the end of the last year. And I said, you know, I should give this film another chance just to sort of see it. Now, one of the things we're going to talk about today is sort of seeing movies again. And I should preface that discussion by saying that I don't actually usually like to see movies again. I'm not exactly Pauline Kael-like, where, you know, she thought she didn't need to. I just don't find it very interesting usually. I tend to have, oftentimes at least, the same kind of experience. I don't necessarily see movies differently the second or third time through. And so unless I really, really like a film, I don't feel always the need, or the desire, I should say, to see it again. But I said, I'm going to give this another shot. And so I went with a friend to see Mulholland Drive. And I had a completely different experience. One, and this was the key part, and my friend and I talked about this afterwards, I was struck by how easy it was to follow what was going on. I mean, sort of, it helps, of course, to know what's coming. But in retrospect, it was like, how did I miss this the first time? I mean, how was, because it's not that hard to figure out. He's moving back and forth in time. But Lynch gives you lots of sort of clues of how to recognize when you're going back and forth in time. There's this blue key, and there's sort of various other things that are fairly obviously sort of highlighted. You know, notice this. That gives you the sense of where you are in the sense of the story.
Now, do you think having the lay of the land was the key difference there, or was it just that you're a more sophisticated film viewer now?
Well, and that's a great question, and I think it's probably both. I mean, I think certainly having the lay of the land had an idea. I knew what was coming, and so the clues that of what's coming were much easier to spot. and much easier to follow who the people were. And, oh, that's right, that's that person's going to become this person. And so I could sort of ask myself, you know, is it really someone different or is it just a different point in time? But, you know, I'd like to think that 10 years later I'm a more sophisticated viewer. But I think part of it, too, and this is what I hope we can talk about a bit today, is I think I just look at movies differently. And that I expect certain things from movies, or for me personally. And I'm much more comfortable now with sort of disjointed narratives, or narratives that don't always come together, or narratives that... don't necessarily have to tie everything together. You know, maybe 10, 11 years ago, that was a more important value for me in analyzing a film, whereas now it's fairly unimportant. Have you seen Mulholland Drive more than once?
Yeah, I have. And I'm one of those people who had it on my decade list at number eight.
Maybe you were, I was thinking of.
Maybe so. Yeah, for me, the reason that I had it up there at number eight on my decade list was it's confounding, but... compelling, and I don't understand how that works. I really just I don't get it. Randomness isn't interesting, you know.
Okay. Right.
If someone shows you just random images on a screen, generated by a computer or something, it's not interesting. It isn't random, you know. There's a method to the madness, and yet there may not be an answer to the puzzle necessarily. Mm-hmm. There are some answers. There are some puzzle pieces that can be assembled here, but something about it is just compelling regardless.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's because it somehow functions as vignettes that echo, that ricochet off of each other. Are you waiting? And it isn't just that you're waiting to see how they come together, because they don't necessarily, and I've seen it again and it was still compelling, you know, knowing that they weren't going to come together. Why is that? Is it simply his style, which he has lots of? Is it the confidence that he has as he's driving through these images? It seems like he knows exactly why he has put it together this way, and he wants this here, and it's weird and sort of funny. I think maybe it's not funny at all, actually. I don't know. I can't figure out are there certain scenes that make me smile? Definitely.
The cowboy,
you know, if you see me once, you did good. If you see me twice, you did bad. You know, what does that even mean? I don't know. But, yeah, it's just any movie that can just sort of completely confuse me, but at the same time really keep me engaged and interested in wanting to piece it together, has got something going for it.
One of the things that I had forgotten until we were sort of lucky before our screening, one of the producers of Mulholland Drive happened to be in town producing a different film and was nice enough to show up before the screening and talk a little bit about the making of the screening.
Wow, neat.
Yeah, it was neat. But one of the things I had forgotten until he started talking about it was, of course, originally made as a pilot. It was designed as a pilot for a TV show for ABC. And so he was sort of talking about that, and then once it was turned down as a pilot... the way he described it was really funny, but apparently it was loathed at the studio. But it was, you know, they had to figure out how to salvage this and how to do something with it, and sort of shooting different material. But I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, about why it feels somewhat vignette-like, and this, the producer was talking about this. He was talking about when you make a pilot, part of what you're doing is trying to set up a whole bunch of storylines that may not come to fruition for two or three seasons. You know, you're sort of just saying, here are the possibilities. And I think the movie, if you sort of look at it in that light, one, makes maybe a little more sense just in why it feels the way it does. But it also gives me a really much more profound appreciation for Lynch, and like, he takes what would have been completely open-ended and brings some of it together, you know, and creates enough narrative coherence, even though, as you say, a lot of it doesn't cohere and isn't meant to. But there's enough there that you come to the end and you say, that's the end. And I think that's quite impressive. And I noticed that, or appreciated it much more the second time through.
Yeah, definitely.
Are there other films that you've seen multiple times where your ideas about the movies changed?
Well, when you told me that you thought this would be an interesting thing to talk about, I was trying to think of examples of that. And one that came to mind was Claire Denis' movie Friday Night.
Which I haven't seen, I'm sorry to say.
It's I came to that movie as a Claire Denis fan and as a cinephile and a pretty, I would think, experienced film goer. I knew what I was getting into. Mm-hmm. I knew who she was. I knew the type of movies she makes. And yet, the first time I saw it, I liked it, but I felt like maybe there wasn't as much there as I was hoping. Mm. I saw it again several months later and was shocked at how every scene spoke to me. Mm. Every scene had something. Every scene had a purpose. I saw this sort of subjective vision that she had for everything. You know, I feel like most of the movie is subjectively through the character's eyes, and that affects everything from the framing to what you're hearing as you're watching something. I mean, throughout, beginning to end. And it was shocking to me that knowing how Claire Denis works wasn't enough to sort of see a lot of that. And I love that about a really good filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I find that my very favorite filmmakers are able to do this. Somehow they're able to hide things in plain sight.
Okay.
So that it requires a little bit of picking, a little bit of chipping away at that to get at it. And then once you do, it's like some sort of gleaming light shines through.
Is it because you need to see it a second time to appreciate it? Or is it because you are at a different place the second time that you see it?
I don't know. I think I've wondered that myself, because certainly for me it does feel like it helps me to see it a second time. But when I do see it a second time, it's sort of like your experience with Mulholland Drive. I see all the clues that she gave. Yeah. It was all there. It wasn't like you have to see it a second time because then you'll know that means that.
Right.
It's all there. Yeah. It is properly constructed for a single viewing. And I should emphasize that I certainly didn't dislike it the first time.
Right.
But my feelings about it just really grew after seeing it again.
I had a sort of somewhat the opposite experience when I saw Full Metal Jacket earlier last year, at the end of last year. Doc Films here in Chicago was doing a Kubrick retrospective, and so I was catching up with movies I sometimes hadn't seen in 10, 12 years, which was fantastic fun. But my experience of Full Metal Jacket, as much as I still really love that movie, which I do, was diminished on the second viewing. Because I knew what was coming, particularly in the first half, and again, not to spoil things, but there's a very key moment that happens in the middle of that film, on which sort of the rest of the film then pivots.
Should we go ahead? Maybe since it's an older movie, we should go ahead and say if it helps.
Sure. So Vincent D'Onofrio's character, Private Pyle, is the first half of the movie takes place in basic training. It's these bunch of young kids basically who are about to be thrown into Vietnam, but first they're thrown into basic training, and as a lot of Kubrick is, it's a bravura 45-minute sequence or so of the drill sergeant it's hard to describe what he does, but breaking these guys down and trying to build them back up again. But with Private Pyle's character, the breaking him down doesn't do anything but break him down, and so in the middle of the movie he ends up shooting the drill sergeant and killing him, and then killing himself. And in the first time I saw the movie, it was a completely shocking moment, and very, very emotionally powerful. But watching it the second time through, it seemed very obvious what was coming. And I don't think that was necessarily because I wasn't paying attention the first time, maybe so. But sort of the Vincent D'Onofrio is not always the subtlest actor anyway. And so the way he sort of communicates that he's getting disturbed. Worse and worse more and more disturbed just seemed really painfully obvious to me the second time through, and this climax in the middle didn't seem to have quite the power that it had the first time through. And so when I saw Full Metal Jacket the first time, I liked the first half quite a bit better than the second half. Whereas the second time around, I liked the second half better, because the first half was at least somewhat, not ruined, that's too strong a word, but lessened because I already knew what was coming.
Stanley Kubrick is an interesting case for me too, I think, because I think I like all of his movies now probably as much as I always did, but for completely different reasons, which is another reason that he's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
I think his movies have a sort of simple, visceral appeal that someone who's in high school or college can like. That's when when I first saw these movies.
Right.
Even though I know from watching them that I maybe am not understanding all of it. You know, whenever I see 2001, I don't understand how the pieces fit together. This is my high school self.
Yeah.
Don't know how they all fit together, what they have to do with each other. But how can you not love that? Hal, open the pod bay doors, Hal, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's true of all of his movies. Mm-hmm. And Full Metal Jacket is similar, you know, that to me it was like, it's like two movies that were stuck together. And the first one was so sort of funny and engaging, although it ends tragically. And then what to make of the second one, I have no idea. Well, now that split is what's interesting to me.
Yeah.
And what are the, what is it that connects those two? It has to, seems to be, have something to do with gender. I mean, whenever you even think about the language that's used in all of those insults that he hurls at people, they're that's very loaded sexually. They're weird. It's weird, actually. But not, it sort of feels natural the way he sort of says it. Maybe, maybe, you know, but somehow it's, it flows off of his tongue.
Yeah.
Arlie Ermey's tongue.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, he's all, I think all of his movies have changed somewhat for me in that way, but I still like them. The Shining is the one that has maybe grown the most because it was maybe because it was the one that didn't clearly have any sort of artsy pretensions necessarily. It didn't clearly have pieces that I didn't think I understood. Where now it does. And so it's different, you know. To see the African-American bleeding on the Native American rug is like, okay, this is, there's more going on here than Stephen King intended. You
That's right. Yeah, and actually The Shining was one of the other ones I saw again recently. And here, like you, my appreciation had grown even more, and I really liked the movie the first time, but you know, what I was particularly struck by the second time, and this is because I hopefully have become more sophisticated as a film viewer, but I was just amazed at the sound design. You know, the sound design in that film is just mind-blowing, you know, what's being communicated. In the, and the most of the horror, I think, in the film comes from the sound and the sense of dread that, that the sound evokes. And at times it's very, very loud. But then other times it's just totally quiet. And there's nothing. And so I was particularly sort of appreciative of that, but you know, it but yeah, my experience of The Shining, the, you know, 10 years later was much more positive even than the first time, and that's saying a lot.
That big wheel rolling across those rugs, you know, intermittently hitting the tile floor or wood floor, whatever it is, and the sound of the racquetball hitting the walls, the murals, actually, you know, it's kind of crazy. Yeah.
But I also, one of the things that was nice too about The Shining was it strikes me as the movie that seems closest to Eyes Wide Shut, Kubrick's last film, which I like a great deal. And so to watch The Shining sort of thinking about Eyes Wide Shut was fun, to make sort of certain connections or to think about certain thematic you know, resonances. That was fun. And I think that's one of the things I mentioned to you when we were talking about this before, that, you know, I happened to see Kozlowski's Blue, White, Red. This is maybe 2 years ago. I'd seen these films many times, but it had been several years since I'd watched them back to back to back. And
these are three films called Blue, White, and Red.
That's right. In that order. That's right. And
the colors of the French flag.
That's right. And sort of made as a trilogy, designed that way in the early 90s. And to watch the three of them in close sequence had the same joy, you know, of sort of, you know, being able to think about, wow, there's a lot going on here, and things that I noticed, you know, 6-7 years ago, the last time I did this, but yet I caught so much more, and there was so much more to appreciate on that level.
So you still liked them as well as you always
did? Even more so. I mean, those are, you know, Blue is maybe the film that really got me into film. But, you know, I appreciated White much more this time than I had earlier. And but particularly seeing how they worked together was really, really fantastic.
I should go back and watch White and Red again sometime, because I liked all three also. But Blue, I really liked Blue.
Yeah.
And every time I've intended to go back and watch all three of them again, I just sort of stop with Blue and think, all right, well, that'll do. You know, that'll do. Juliette Binoche is great. She clearly, her husband and children are killed at the very beginning of the movie, tragically. And the way that's conveyed is actually really, the exposition is just masterful.
Yeah.
I mean, there are no words, nothing.
No.
And her, she's alive to live with this now. Her husband was a composer.
Right.
And it becomes clear that he's a famous composer, actually. Mm-hmm. And it becomes clear that she helped him with that.
Yes.
Was actually a co-composer. Maybe more.
Yeah.
And
but no one else knows that.
Right. And so in some ways, not only is her family gone, but she, a piece of her is ripped out, because can she now pick up the mantle and be, you know, she had music in her still. Right. She's a composer.
Yes. Yes.
And yet, does she have an outlet for that?
Yeah, and if you haven't seen Blue, I always feel bad recommending it for people who can only watch it on TV, because it's a big movie.
Yeah.
Not in the Kubrickian sense. I mean, it's, but yet, I mean, you need a really great sound system, you know, because it's about music. And as the movie goes on, she takes this piece that he had been working on, that originally she had thrown away. You know, she didn't want anyone to sort of even know that it existed, but sort of a copy is saved, and she picks it up and she starts finishing this. And the way that Kozlowski sort of brings that together is, I think, I haven't seen many movies about the art of composing, but I can't think of anyone better or any movie better than that. You know, this idea of how does a composer work? How does a composer think about how this music works and how various instruments, you know, come together? And so if you get a chance to see it, try to see it with as great a sound system as you can. But know that I think that's absolutely right.
I have to also say that, similar to Mulholland Drive, I don't always understand what's so compelling about Blue, because there is a long stretch where she's grieving and she's just very quiet. There's very little dialogue. She's trying to sort of restart her life in a new place and a new, you know, find a new home and all that. And we get a clear sense of what she's feeling, but it's a pretty long stretch, and it's just interesting to watch that and see how that happens. But I don't, to describe long stretches where not much is happening doesn't necessarily sound interesting, but it's riveting.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of it at least has to go to Juliette Binoche, who just, you know, she's always great, but amazingly great, I think, in Blue. But going back to Mulholland Drive, I was struck by how really great Naomi Watts is.
Yeah. Basically unknown at the time.
That's right. That's right. I mean, she sort of bursts onto the scene in that movie. And I just had forgotten how truly fantastic she is, because in Mulholland Drive, she's got to do a lot. I mean, there's a lot of very different kinds of roles she has to play, and every one is compelling. Every one feels right.
She has to be the caricature of the wide-eyed newbie in Los Angeles,
right,
who might break into show business, you know, and then the jaded, cynical, it never happened, was it ever even a possibility, completely strung out kind of existence.
But also there's in-betweens. I mean, I think sometimes the extremes might be sort of easier, but she's able to sort of take you through that process.
Yeah.
And I think pretty compelling ways, just in the same way that Binoche is able to sort of take you through this, you know, I mean, just you feel her grieving. And it's just powerful for that.
Have you gone back to see the Decalogue anytime recently? That's the 10-part sort of TV series. They're actually like 1-hour movies, 10 of them, that Kieślowski made just before Blue, White, Red.
I not in the last 3 or 4 years. Maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, I watched them all again, in part because a theater here in Chicago was playing them.
Huh.
And so I got to see maybe 5 or 6 on the big screen, and then I watched the others that I had on DVD just because, well, you wanted to fill it in. But I think it's interesting, and we're talking now about films, you know, one of the joys of watching them again is to then be able to compare them, you know, and sort of, because you notice things, right? I mean, the second or third time through, you inevitably sort of just notice more. And so with the Decalogue, every time I watch that again, I appreciate it more and more for what it's trying to do.
Yeah.
Have you seen it recently?
It's been quite a while. I saw a couple of them on the big screen in San Francisco. That was my introduction to them. And then I like you, I had to fill them out on video, but they were made for TV, so that's actually not a bad way to see them. But they're really interesting to think of together also, because it's, you know, they're based on the Ten Commandments. He always liked these sort of grand connecting themes, but they're based on the Ten Commandments. But sometimes it's not always clear, like, why does this story match the adultery commandment, you know?
Yeah.
And to think about why he did those things is really kind of cool.
It is. And also, I think there's resonances with other movies. You know, I think there's certain moments in the Decalogue that reappear in Blue, that reappear in Double Life of Veronique. There certainly are. I mean, he had, obsessions is way too strong a word, but he had the themes that he really enjoyed coming back to, and yet they come differently each time he comes back to them, and that makes it sort of fun to compare, but also fun to revisit them, and it's like, oh yeah, that's right, right.
Now someday we need to podcast about Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah.
It's almost strange that we never have rarely mentioned him on this podcast to say that, because I think of all the filmmakers that I like, he's probably the one who is, I feel like I have the most unusual reaction to. I've loved Chaplin for a long time, but I think, I don't know, my feelings about his movies are very complicated okay. to me anyway. But it's interesting to think about it in this conversation, because I first saw his movies when I was young, in junior high or something, and loved them. I mean, kids will love Chaplin if they get a chance to see him. So it's not a surprise that a kid would like Chaplin. But as with a lot of things that you like when you're a kid, when you get older, they fall away.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you go back and look at them and you like them, but you like them in a very special way. You either like them through the eyes of your kid self, you know, or you realize how hokey they are, one or the other, you know. Like, I still like those underdog cartoons or something, but you don't really like them as an adult, right? You like them because you always kind of love those, and they're nostalgic. That's nostalgia, that's what it is. But that isn't the case with Chaplin for me, and I think partly it's because I didn't go for a long gap and not see them. I've just watched them all along, and the surprise for me has been how bottomless they are. Mm. Like the whole, I feel like I keep uncovering new things that I have never thought of, and that seems impossible. I've seen them hundreds of times, and part of it is also reading about his life, and sometimes I don't like to do that with filmmakers. I just like to see the films in isolation.
Yep.
But his movies in particular they mesh well with the things that were going on in his life, where they, at least reading about the circumstances that brought them about, enhances the whole idea of what's going on here. And just the way they are so contradictory. They are simple and clumsy and perfect and beautiful at the same time.
Yeah.
It's just really strange. Mm. And so I can never get to the bottom of it. And I don't think a year has gone by that I haven't found some new thing that I never thought of. Sometimes it's like, you know, that Bertolucci movie, The Dreamers, there's a guy who mentioned something about the end of City Lights. I've seen the end of City Lights, literally, I've seen it hundreds of times, and I never thought of that. I've never thought of the way he describes the end of City Lights. It was beautiful. And so, you know, I hope that continues forever.
Nice. Yeah, and it's, you know, I started by saying that I don't really like watching movies a second time. But that's not true with movies that I really, really like, you know, because they're... I think there is depths to mine. This doesn't fit quite in that category, but you were talking about the seeing something as a kid and then going back and visiting it again. At the very beginning of last year, I had a chance to see The Sting, old Paul Newman, Robert Redford film from the 70s. Well, I mean, this was one of my mom and dad's favorite movies growing up, and so I watched it a lot as a kid and loved it as a kid. I'll never forget the first time I saw it, and there's a twist at the end, and I was completely floored by the twist at the end. But I hadn't seen the movie in probably 15 years. And so I trekked up to the music box because I said, oh, this will be great fun to see this again. And what I was struck by was, again, I watched it differently than I did it as a kid, but how much I appreciated it still, and for very different reasons, but it was, but also because of the nostalgia. And so it was a mix of both. It was a sort of taking me back to childhood, and particularly to certain things about my parents. But also it's like understanding its place in film history, understanding sort of what's going on in movies at that point in time and why The Sting is the way it is also was very interesting to me. And it was interesting to appreciate that in a way that I could never have done even maybe 5 years ago. I'm at the place I started really watching movies maybe 15 years ago. And in those first 5 years, I tried to see as many of the classics as I could. And a lot of those I haven't seen now in 10 years. And so I'm feeling like I've reached a point in my film viewing career, if you can call it a career, but where it's time to go back to some of those. And the experience of the last year and a half has been really fruitful and enjoyable. And, you know, maybe for me, I don't want to watch movies the same, you know, rewatch it 1 or 2 years, but 5, 10 years, oh, now we're ready to rewatch some of those things again. Thank you.
Hey, J. Robert.
Hey, Rob.
So, we have something to reveal about this conversation that we just heard, and it's that it was recorded three years ago, January 2011.
Yeah, it's a long time ago.
And it's actually hard to there's not a really good explanation for why it has taken this long to release that conversation. I don't have a very hard job when it comes to this podcast. We sit down, usually here at your apartment, have a conversation about movies. I take the recording home. I tack on a little intro with some music and a little exit with some music and splice out anything that's particularly offensive. But that's rare. And for some reason, life got busy. That one was a little short.
I heard Parenthood is overwhelming at times.
It's quite overwhelming. Sometimes the podcast takes a backseat to other things. And we kept thinking, I'll put it out at some point. And then you and I went to see Line Describing a Cone, yeah. Which was so cool. We had to talk about it right away, and I was excited to get that out. And I just sort of skipped over that one that had been sitting in the queue, and we put that out. And then I don't ever get back to it.
Yeah, didn't even think about it.
And so I said to you, hey, why don't we revisit that? Mm-hmm. It was a couple of years ago, I said. And then when I had to like scratch my eyes and look at the date when I actually pulled it up and realized it was 3 years ago. Yeah. Do you ever go back and listen to our podcast episodes?
You know, I went back. I do actually sometimes. It's funny. I don't know if you had this experience when you were reviewing for Paste. But often when I would review a movie for whatever publication I was writing for at the time, usually the Hyde Park Herald, I would be sort of unsatisfied with what I wrote. It didn't really quite capture what I thought about the movie. But amazingly, if I'd go back and read it 2 years later, it's like, oh, that was pretty good. And so sometimes I have the same experience when we do the podcast. You know, I've particularly movies I like when we did the Killer Sheep podcast, the Charles Burnett. I've listened to that a few times just because I really like that recording. I really like what you did with the music in that and taking parts of the movie and using them as sonic effects. I thought that was great. So yeah, I do go back and listen to the podcast and have the same kind of surprise and joy as when I used to go back and reread my own reviews.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, and do you?
Sometimes, because enough time goes by between these, sometimes we have these long gaps that I can't remember. What did we say when we talked about Killer of Sheep, for example? Or I like that True Grit one. Or sometimes I have gone back to listen to that first interview with Guy Madden, which I'm always surprised sounds is fun and entertaining, I think. But I always find something like when I went back and listened to this conversation about rewatching movies. I felt like, oh, there were things that I can't believe I left out, or I was leading to something and I never got to it. If this were an essay, it'd be like it didn't have that last two paragraphs or something. But since it's a conversation, things just drift. But I can't believe in this one that I didn't mention Alain René, the great French filmmaker who has been on our minds recently because he died this year. But he died at the age of 91, having made a ton of great movies.
That's true.
And one of my very favorites is Last Year at Marion Bod. And this is truly like one of my top five movies of all time. And I'm surprised I didn't mention it because they had a new print of it. They made a new print of this great black and white movie. And they were showing it in 35 millimeter. This was like 7 or 8 years ago. And they showed it for a week in San Francisco. And I thought, wow, I've got to catch that. I'd like to see that as much as I can, really. And I mentioned that online somewhere on a blog. And our mutual friend Michael Smith said, I'd go to every screening if I could. And I thought, well, maybe I should try to see that. I saw it three times, so I didn't catch every screening, but I saw it three times in a week, and I had already seen it many times. But the movie itself is a reflection on, it's about memories and fragments, and it's about these people who have gone into this house, and they're talking about what happened last year at Marion Bod. I think they're at Marion Bod, but it's never entirely clear what's going on. It's never clear what happened last year. There are conflicting reports, and memories are hazy, and the whole thing is about just this idea of how memories are so inaccurate and so fragmented sometimes. And it's just it's a bottomless film because I saw it already familiar with it. I saw it three times and saw something new every single time that I saw it in this week. When he died recently, David Hudson, writing in his great film blog that he does regularly, of course, collected all of the remembrances of René that people were writing all over the web, which are really great. And he was talking about Marion Bod, and I was reading his thing, and there were comments at the bottom. People were posting why Marion Bod was great. But my favorite was from Ryland Walker Knight, cinephile from San Francisco. Yeah.
he had just one little comment, which was, it's also really, really funny, which is so true because that movie is, it feels a little stilted at first, I think. It feels really arch or like, oh, it's like vegetables or I've got to watch this for my film class and write an essay on it or something, blah, blah, blah. But it's actually very funny.
It is funny. It
is. One of the things I had never noticed before I saw it again in that week was... there's a cutout of Alfred Hitchcock in the background. Oh. The first time, it's really quick, the first time I thought, was that a person hovering in the back? What was that? So the second time I made sure to watch, and I was pretty sure that that was Alfred Hitchcock's silhouette. And sure enough, the third time, I'm absolutely sure it was. Funny things like that are all through the movie, and each scene is a puzzle of some kind.
Right.
They come so quickly, I can't figure them all out. Here's a camera rolling down a hallway toward mirrors, and yet we can't see it in the mirror. How is this done? All these kinds of things are so, so cool. Mm. But René also was a filmmaker who seemed to be exploring this idea over and over again. And he continued making movies that were good and challenging and just as weird as Marion Bodd up until the end of his life. Yeah. And he has one more that actually hasn't been released yet that I'm eager to see. Mm. But it's I always wish that somehow my life were so well structured that I was continually to explore a theme from different angles. I'm always too chaotic in whatever it is I'm doing that I'm all scattered. But he really seemed to be sort of exploring this theme over and over again in different ways, and was really really good at that. Mm. I remember years ago I found this little chapbook called, let me see, what was it called? Called The Cinema of Alain René. It's a little book from 1968 that's been long out of print. And it had a little snippet of an interview from some French magazine called Cinema 65 that I don't know of. It's from 1965. But they had this great little snippet of him talking about when he was a child. Mm. And I have to read this quote. He said, "I had a piece of film that I used to show myself all the time under the piano. It lasted 2 minutes, and you could see galloping horses' hooves, a mysterious stranger turning his head, a lady dressed in white lace holding a pair of opera glasses and accompanied by a gentleman in a top hat. Mm. I saw this film hundreds of times, and it wasn't until almost 35 years later that I saw Renoir's Nana at the Cinematheque and suddenly shouted out, 'That's my piece!' So I would say I'm very much influenced by Renoir." And I love this because one of his strongest influences isn't a Renoir film in total, but a memory fragment that took 35 years to resolve.
That's nice. It's funny, I saw Marion Bodd actually, I think, at the same time, but for the first time. And in part because I had it in my mind that it was kind of like eating vegetables, and so I had not gone out of my way to see it. But then when that new print came around, I was playing with the music box on the north side, and I was shocked. Shocked at how great it was. Not how great it was, I guess, but shocked at how enjoyable it was. You know, it was, it's a puzzle, and if you don't sort of like thinking through puzzles when you're watching movies, then you're not going to like it. But it was really fascinating and funny and rich and it, you could tell that it would bear repeat viewings. You know, to go back to our earlier discussion, you know, sometimes when I see movies, like a lot of times when I see movies, I don't feel like I've seen a lot new from a film. I see maybe the same things, which I enjoy. But that's a film that you definitely see a lot each time. You know, it's because there's just no way you can capture it all. Another thing, and this reminds me, a very different kind of filmmaker, and yet I like the pairing. How long has it been since the Ozu series went around?
Oh, that was, like 2004.
Yeah, so 10 years ago now.
2003, maybe. Yeah.
But I remember when that came around, it came to Chicago last, so I actually think it didn't get here until 2005 or even 2006. I remember thinking at the time, I hope it doesn't take 10 more years for this to come around again, you know, and yet it kind of has. And I've been thinking about that lately. It's like, wouldn't it be great to have the Ozu series again, where in a 2 month span of time, you just got to immerse yourself and revisit all these movies. I mean, obviously you can revisit on DVD, of course, and most of Ozu is on DVD now, but I don't know, there's something different about a retrospective. There's a difference, I think, in particular, because when you watch those kinds of movies again with people, the conversations are richer. You know, there's particularly someone like Ozu. I remember when that came through. For a lot of us, it was our first really immersive experience in this great Japanese filmmaker. And that, we just kept coming back to that again and again in conversations. And I've been thinking quite a bit in the last several months of, wouldn't it be great to have that experience again, of being able to immerse ourselves as a cinephile community and a director we really love, and seeing new things this time, and as well as revisiting old things.
Yeah, well, his films were hard to see before. Someone right. collected basically all of the extant films and thankfully, you know, shared them with us.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I saw them in Berkeley, saw most of them in Berkeley, the crowd was so interesting because it was a bunch of film buffs, but it was also a bunch of older people who knew mm-hmm. these actors and knew this filmmaker and knew these films in some cases, mm-hmm. you know, old people from Japan or mm-hmm. who were just, you know, the joy on their faces whenever, you know, a lot of the titles weren't translated in some of these films, but they were the names of actors and they were in kanji characters that I can't read, but you could hear this Chishu Ryu going through the audience. Oh, there's Chishu. I know. I guess Chishu Ryu is in this one, of course. He's in most of them. But, you know, it was really fun to be mm-hmm. just in that for a month and a half.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have you seen any other movies recently that we were visiting that sort of had you thinking about this?
Well, we were talking recently about The Act of Killing, and we mentioned Jean Rouch mm-hmm. And about how he had gone back. He had shown cuts of his film to the people who were in it the same way that Joshua Oppenheimer did mm-hmm. in The Act of Killing.
That's right.
And similar to what we're doing, revisiting our podcast here, I suppose. But I was thinking about how Jean Rouch did this, had this idea of revisiting from the filmmaker's perspective that was actually really cool. He was really enamored early on with these lightweight cameras. This was a new mm-hmm. technology. And now we sort of take it for granted that you can walk around on streets and film people or go into their homes and film people and follow people around. But you couldn't do that back then very easily until, you know, mid-50s when they started to come out with these cameras that you could actually hold and carry and film. And he was interested in documenting things that he saw in Niger and stuff like that. So one of his early experiences was that he went on a hippo hunt and he filmed it. And I think people forget this too, because video cameras record both pictures and sounds together at the same time and keep them together. But film cameras don't do that. Mm. The film camera records just the images and you have another machine that records the sound. And if you're just one guy who's on this little boat of people who are hunting hippos in the water, you don't necessarily want to record the sound too. Sure. So he just had the camera. And people always asked him, why don't you use a tripod? And he actually had two answers to that. One, he would say he doesn't like a zoom lens because a zoom lets you lie about how close you are to the people. Mm. You need to be walking among the people if you're showing people up close. But the other answer he would sometimes say is that he dropped his tripod in the water on a hippo hunt and just has never replaced it. Rouch was a very cool and funny guy. But actually something did interesting happen with that film that he made from the hunt. He shot the footage, and then he had also separately recorded some of the music from the village. And when he went back to his suite, he edited this together, and he put some music with it. And he thought, I'm going to show it to the people there, see what they think. And he did that. And they were aghast that he put this music, which apparently was very ill-suited to this picture and this hunt and the atmosphere of the hunt. Mm. And he had no idea. He had not picked up on this and didn't know this and made this faux pas. And he said, think about how different this would be if this were just traditional anthropology. He was trained as an anthropologist, sort of became a filmmaker out of that later. But he was talking about how traditional anthropology, someone comes, they observe for a while, and then they write their observations in a paper. But that paper isn't read by the people they observed. It's read by the people in France or England or America who don't have the context that the people who were actually being written about would have. Mm. And so it's part of what he loved about film is that he said, it's the only way I can show someone how I see him or her. And so it affected everything that he did after that point. And another of his movies that's very famous, probably his first feature, is called Jaguar. And it was about these guys, these young men in Niger, a certain time of the year, they take a kind of a 3-month summer trip to Ghana, and they walk mostly on foot. They travel to Ghana and they have adventures on the way, and they pick up odd jobs to pay their way. And when they get there, they have a little shop where they sell things on the beach. And it's a shop with the longest name I can think. It's something like Little by Little, the Bird Makes His Nest or something. They had to find this big long board to... Petit à Petit is the short, Little by Little is the short version of their store's name. Anyway, he went along with them, and he captured this trip, and he's with them for 3 months, and he's filming. And again, they didn't always record the sound, but he thought, we're going to add the sound later, but we're going to do it together. I'm not going to do it myself. So when they're all done editing, they go back and when they're all done filming, they go back and he edits with them, and they get to record their own soundtrack, basically dubbing their own voices. And anytime they see themselves on the screen putting on sunglasses, they all say Jaguar. It seems to be their word for cool. It's like saying, look how Jaguar we are, you know, Jaguar. So that's the title of the film. And it's a very silly movie, but it really is a joyous look at sort of life in various villages and countries that they pass through along the way, and just the what life is like at this time in these people's lives and this age. They're young and they can sort of drift for a while. It's sort of, you know, before they take on responsibilities. And it was one of the first looks of long, you know, films that looked at this from, you know, a Western perspective that really tried to make it collaborative. And so his idea of revisiting from the filmmaker's perspective was really profound.
Mm. Your story of, the idea of a filmmaker wanting to be able to show how he sees you is, I think, a really interesting one. It reminds me of that really wonderful moment in Edward Yang's Yi Yi, where the boy is taking photographs. And the boy is clearly a stand-in for the director, and he has the same name. And he's taking pictures of the backs of people's heads, and it's like, why are you taking the backs of people's heads? And he goes, because you can't see the backs of your head, so I show you. And that sort of really beautiful description of what movies are, in a way. It's like, here, it's my way of showing you who you are, because you can't see this side of yourself. And I think that's a really lovely description of I think really good film. I mean, both documentaries as well as fiction films, and that idea of revealing something about ourselves that we for whatever reason can't see ourselves. And I think that's that story reminds me of that.
Yeah, and it reveals something about the attitude of the person taking the picture too, or the person making the film. Mm-hmm. You mentioned American Hustle, and that you've been wanting to talk about The Sting also. I know you like that movie.
I do.
And so you sort of compared them, and I was thinking a little bit about the two, because I ended up seeing American Hustle also. And it feels like they have such different viewpoints on the periods they're depicting. You know, The Sting looks like it's made by people who love this period, don't remember it because it was a little too far back, but what they depict of it is very neat. The music is cool, the clothes are neat, the typography of the opening credits, things like that are sort of very quaint. Whereas American Hustle, David O. Russell seems to depict it as ugly. I mean, the clothes are ugly, the fashion, you know, the fashion and the hairstyles and things like that are it's two different viewpoints of their periods.
Yeah, if we were going to be really theoretical about this, we would talk about the difference between modernism and postmodernism, but that'll be boring for everyone listening. So we won't do that. But I do think there is that sense of you know, in American Hustle, which I love, because I just find it really funny. But, I mean, certainly the dominant tone is ironic, whereas the dominant tone in The Sting is homage. And it's a sense of trying to pay homage to, really, I think, classical Hollywood. I think The Sting, you know, made in 1973, is at a really interesting place in American movie history. It's a big budget movie. It had huge stars. You know, Robert Redford and Paul Newman were reprising their kind of buddy movie from a few years before, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And so I think that movie, The Sting, sometimes gets a little bit of a bad rap because it's seen as just sort of this big budget, period piece. And yet I think it really is a movie about the transition in Hollywood to New Hollywood, in the sense that here's how we used to make movies. And we're reaching the point where we can't make movies like this anymore. And so I like to, when I watch The Sting, and I don't know how many times I've watched that movie because it was a favorite of my parents growing up, or when I was growing up. But it feels like a movie for a bygone era. Whereas American Hustle, as much as I like that movie, feels like it's making fun of a bygone era. It's another movie. This is on the opposite end of the spectrum from Jean Rouch. I saw Groundhog Day not long ago, in part because I was kind of strangely saddened by the death of Harold Ramis. I wouldn't say he was a great filmmaker by any means, but I don't know. There was something about him that I appreciated. Maybe just he was a Chicago guy and it felt connected to him in that way. But watching Groundhog Day again, I was struck by how kind of sad the movie is. I mean, it's funny. Bill Murray is incredibly funny. And yet there's lots of parts in that movie that aren't funny at all. And there's a sadness to them. And it's a kind of existential sadness that I had forgotten about. And so revisiting that movie, maybe the sadness comes in light of Harold Ramis's death. But that sense of, I saw it differently seeing it again. And that was kind of cool. I enjoyed that.
I have never seen Groundhog Day.
Really?
I will one day. I am not avoiding it. And I know, I understand the premise. Like, it's, repeating the same day over and over, right?
Yeah, it's, what a joy you'll have. I think you don't want to speak for everyone. I think most people agree that it's not only Harold Ramis' best film, but it's one of the really great American comedies, at least of the last 30 years. Bill Murray is perfectly, I was describing the movie to a friend as the romantic comedy a depressive would make. And Bill Murray is a depressed person's leading man. He's the quintessential depressed leading man. And the movie just captures that really beautifully. And Andie MacDowell is fantastic. So she's just perfectly cast. She just has a brightness that helps balance all of Bill Murray's dourness. So, how much fun that you have to look forward to that.
Yeah, that's, definitely.
That'll be good.
So what movie do you think you have seen the most times?
Oh, what a great question. I was thinking of how to talk about this film because it's easy for me. The movie I've seen the most times is the one I showed every semester in my film and advertising class. So I taught that class every semester for 12 years. So I've seen it at least 24 times. And that's Will Success Bull Rock Hunter with Tony Randall. Mid-50s comedy, Tashlin, written and directed by Tashlin. And it's funny, I show the movie because it's a great introduction to both advertising and movies about advertising. That sort of, it's a nice way to kick off the class. I sort of enjoyed exposing students to older films. Routinely, students would say, I thought old movies were boring, and they'd say, I like that one. That was sort of this begrudging admiration for it. But I loved it when I first saw it, and I love it even more now. Not that I think I appreciate it much more. I think the movie is fairly much on the surface. But one of the things that I really love about watching it again and again is just to see how tightly constructed it is. And the jokes are really perfectly timed. Jane Mansfield is great. Tony Randall is great. But all the secondary actors are great too. And there's really witty wordplay that completely goes over the head of my college students. But I think it probably goes over the head of most people the first time they watch it. There's lots of really clever double entendres. That are pretty... Racy is not quite the word. I mean, it's a mid-50s film, but they're clever. There's a lot of sex jokes going on, and particularly around Jane Mansfield. And so, so that's the movie I've seen the most, and probably my appreciation of it on the 24th time isn't that much greater than my appreciation on the first time. But I think the fact that I still enjoy watching it every 6 months is a pretty high praise. How about you? Yeah.
Well, over my whole life, it's probably something like City Lights or The Kid, Chaplin movie, or pieces of Beau Travail or something like that. But more recently, as I have kids, parents end up watching a lot of movies. And although my girls don't watch a lot of TV and movies, like maybe it's probably less than typical. And also my six-year-old daughter is very, very affected by stories. And it's caused me to have to improvise more than I expected and choose. I always sort of imagine, what the perfect movies will be to show my kids, whenever I eventually have kids. And now that I do, I realize you really have to tailor it to the child.
Sure.
And so something like My Neighbor Totoro, the fantastic Miyazaki movie, I think I see it probably differently than I would have if I had seen it before I had Iris. But there are so few movies that aren't trying to scare the wits out of a child. That this movie that just has this wonder about the world and just sees things really from a child's perspective is just, it's really a beautiful movie. I don't know if you've ever seen
Totoro. Yeah, it's great.
It is great. And of course, we've seen, the Pixar movies, the better ones, WALL-E, we've seen several times. Mm. But Totoro is the one we return to the most, probably.
Would you say that, do you think her experience of watching it again and again is different, or does she enjoy it sort of for the same reasons each time?
That's a good question, because she has seen it now probably over 2 years, and she's a very different person now than when she was four. And so I think she picks up things that she didn't pick up the first time. So I imagine it's different. And it's not like she watches it every day or every weekend or nonstop. It's every 4 months or something. That's that's our frequency. It's very, but for her, that's a lot. And it's, I think she gets probably something each time, although she can also talk about it. You know, she kids remember things very well, so she can talk about lots of it when we're between viewings. But I imagine she'll continue to see things. There are things that I don't like to explain movies very much. It's nice to just let her pick up what she picks up, and then later she'll pick up something new, and it's kind of interesting to talk about.
That's so nice. And have you shown her Chaplin?
We have. I actually, of course, thought I would start with Chaplin or something like that. And it's she had seen some animated things, some little animated things. And I think there was something very different about seeing real faces and real people on the screen. And we tried something like the Gold Rush first. And it was, you know, it starts with some bad guys. And this sounds strange, but she was really, really frightened. And we ended up stopping it.
Okay.
I don't want to scare her.
Yeah, sure.
She wanted to see it so badly, but she was really frightened. So we that was back. That was when she was four, and we came back to it later when she was six, and she really. I showed her The Kid.
Okay.
And she really enjoyed it. She finds it very moving, but she really enjoys it. Mm. And before that, I actually had shown her some clips. There's a really great outtake from City Lights of Chaplin playing with a stick stuck in a grate on the street. It's like 8 minutes that he cut out of the movie, but couldn't burn like he did the rest of his stuff, and so someone found it in the 70s in a can in his vault in pristine condition, and it's a beautiful little vignette that just didn't fit into the flow of the movie, but it's on YouTube, and I had it in video form, various forms myself, but I've shown her that, and she loves that, and some little pieces like that she likes. Nice. Yeah.
Are there movies that you are looking forward to revisiting, I mean, that you think are particularly prime for, you know, like, I should watch that again, I think I'd appreciate it differently now than I did when I saw it?
I think almost anything by these very contemplative filmmakers, Ho Xiao Xin, for example, I get something every time, but I also don't like to put them on a repeat a lot. I like to let some time pass between. So maybe not in particular films, but particular filmmakers. And with people like him, and Ozu, and these sort of the greats, Rene is another one of these, I'm glad I have tried to reserve a few movies that I haven't seen.
Yeah.
Like even when I was watching, like, was very close to seeing every extant Ozu film. I think I lack two.
Okay.
And I stopped at that point. I even have them on DVD, and I've never watched them. I got them as a gift, and I didn't unwrap them. It's the story of Floating Weeds and Floating Weeds. I'll watch them one day. But I've tried to think, you know, those are two that I'll just reserve.
Sure.
And one day I'll have another Ozu film that I've never seen before that I'll get to watch.
Yeah.
And that's also true for Ho Xiao Xin, and that's true for Rene has half a dozen that I have not seen that I'm eager to watch at some point, but not, there's no rush yet. Have you seen anything good lately?
I watched Straight Story again, speaking of revisiting movies, the David Lynch film, which of course is the least David Lynch movie. I love that film. I was showing it to some people, and they found it really, really slow. And that was a little discouraging. It's like, oh really? Well, you didn't find it full of grace? You didn't find it full of truth? Oh well. I don't think I've seen anything new though since we talked last. It's been a bit busy, and I've been sort of catching up on some old films, or rewatching some old films. How about you?
Well, I saw the Alan Partridge movie.
Oh,
Alan Partridge
with Steve Coogan.
Yeah, Steve Coogan's character from he's had various incarnations on radio and TV and on the BBC over the years, and I've seen some of that, but not all of it. I'm not a huge aficionado on the Alan Partridge legacy, but I was eager to see the movie, and it's really funny. It's very silly.
Now, have you seen any of the TV show?
Yes.
Okay.
I've seen Knowing Me, Knowing You.
Okay.
Uh huh.
Okay.
Which is his talk show, which is very funny. And I'm a huge fan of Armando Iannucci, who has gone on to do The Thick of It and In the Loop and Veep.
Sure.
And okay. He sort of veered off in a different direction, but he's still somewhat involved in the movie.
Okay.
And the movie's funny. It's just super silly, but it feels to me like it's the density of jokes is much higher than, say, the typical Will Ferrell movie or typical American comedy, which those are funny too. But this just felt like it was lots and lots and lots of silliness.
Okay. Well,
but
good.
Very funny. I was pleasantly surprised. Very funny.
Oh, that sounds good. I'll put it on the list.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Plastic Podcast. Yes, as a fan of Armando Iannucci, I should know how to pronounce his name. That's true. You're right about that. Also, and this seems perfectly fitting in retrospect, I accidentally conflated two blog posts about Alain René and last year at Marienbad. Seems perfect. They got combined in my head. I'm happy to say they both exist separately, a couple of years apart, actually. And I'm also happy to say that I seem to have quoted Mr. Knight perfectly. You can find the show notes for this episode at plasticpodcast.com. You'll find the links to those blog posts. You'll find all the episodes we've done over the last few years, including this one, and whatever comes next. We'll be back next time watching Imitation of Life. You've got to see it. And even if you don't have a chance, I hope you'll join us, and maybe we'll encourage you to make the time. It's worth it. We'll see you then. Bye.